Morning.
Morning.
Spring day in Minnesota, huh? I think it's a little warmer than yesterday. People used to ask me why I left California. Well, why did I leave California?
I don't know why.
Thank you. So in my last talk, my last couple of talks, I talked about happiness and that practice enlightenment on this moment, when we just give ourselves to this activity, is our chance for happiness. And that it's not practice in order to get enlightenment later. It's practice enlightenment right now. And to do that, we have to not be mesmerized by the screen of anxiety and fear, but really give ourselves to the activity, which is so much easier said than done, but that's why we practice. That's why we do meditation. That's why we do practice. So then today I'm going to switch, and I'm going to talk about, well, we have all these series of present moments, but we also are future-oriented beings. We live in the time process. So how are we going to manifest what we deeply care about? And, of course, we have our four vows. We have our four vows. Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. So that's future-oriented, right? We're orienting ourselves toward the future. How are we going to do this, though? Each of us needs to do this in our own authentic way. I mean, these are so general. They're wonderful, but they're general. What do we really care about? How do we want to manifest our lives in the future? What's, as Suzuki Roshi used to say, our inmost request? So in my first book, I talk about Viktor Frankl. And I talk about the fact that in the concentration camps in Germany, the only way he survived was by imagining a future that was important to him. And that one common denominator of all the survivors who led happy lives afterwards is that they thought hard about their life afterwards. Or hard, I don't like that term. They thought, I want to rewrite this book. They thought soft about their life afterwards. And imagine themselves living it. They've been stripped of everything they identified with, the people, the objects, the life which supported them, but they were able to get in touch with what we call in our tradition their dim vision, each of their own dim visions. And so the Zen process, the meditation process, is partly a process of stripping away enough of this sort of superficial chatter so we get in touch with our own dim visions. And historically, the dim vision was used very negatively, as some of you know. But Dogen is a wonderful guy of switching things and changing them around. But historically, the dim vision was the blind grandmother. The blind grandmother who can't see her way. She's totally deluded. And then she tries to get on the path, and gradually she gets enlightened. And she can see. But then Dogen comes along in the 13th century. He says, no, we're all... And he's been practicing for 30 years by then, you know. He said, no, we're all dim visioned. She has cataracts in her eyes, and then she got rid of them. But no, she didn't get rid of them. We've all got cataracts in our eyes. It's this human situation. It's part of being human to have cataracts. And we know this. You know this inside. You may pretend you don't have them, but you have them. We all have them. Anyway, his turning it around then was the way my two teachers turned a phrase around, to not have negative connotations, but actually positive ones. And the meditation process, the Zen process, is a process of opening up to the dim vision, which means descending into darkness. Oh, darkness. We're just getting through the dark time of the year. It's getting light, but it's still cold, so it feels dark. It's supposed to be warm by now. But it didn't follow the schedule. It didn't follow the outline. It's supposed to be progressing from darkness to lightness, from darkness to enlightenment. But here it is with its dim vision. So William Butler Yeats has a poem titled "The Circus Animal's Desertion." The Circus Animal's Desertion. I'm not going to do the whole poem, although I could do. I'd love to do the whole poem, but it would take a couple hours. Circus Animal's Desertion. He writes this poem when he's kind of late in his life. And he's lost his ability, he feels like he's lost his ability to use words to create wonderful worlds that will move people. By that time, everybody thinks he's a really cool poet. And, you know, he's done lots of things. But he feels like he's lost his beginner's mind. He's lost that stuff, and he's lost the tricks that you have to, that you use with circus animals to present yourself well. We all want to present ourselves well, and we have certain tricks that we learn, but he's lost those. And in meditation, too, if our meditation is serious, we get stripped of everything we learn and identified with. Little by little, we get stripped, which is wonderful, but also it can seem awful, but it's wonderful. And the metaphor that I often use is peeling layers of the onion. You cry, and it seems like that layer falls away. You just cry, you open up, you cry, and then another layer. And you cry some more, and then another layer. And that onion, it just keeps going on with layers after layers. And pretty soon there's just a puddle. But the more we do this, the closer we are to our own still center, our own empty center. Referred to in Japanese Zen as mu, or no thingness, nothingness, stillness. So Yeats says at the end of his poem, "Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart. My, my. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start, in the foul rag and bone shop of the heart." So when the ladder's gone, when our idea about that we're gonna get somewhere through this practice, we're gonna finally get stillness later on, and we gotta struggle to get that. We're finally gonna get something later on, and we're gonna just put all our effort into getting that. When we let go of that, we find mu. Wu in Chinese, mu in Japanese. Emptiness, stillness, no thingness, nothingness. Nothingness is the most common translation, but it has such a negative connotation in English that I prefer not to use it, because it's nothingness which includes everything. So that's where and the more we're able to do that, let go of these layers, crying all the way, or if you're not an affect person, just being like this all the way in your sitting. We were trained in the early days just to not cry. Just sit, be like Bodhidharma. So in my first book, I also talk about Katagiri Roshi, the founding teacher here. And I talk about how he frequently talked about his dim vision for the future. His aspiration was to plant the seeds of Zen in this country and encourage them to sprout. Dim vision was his way of reminding himself and us to hold our vision lightly so it doesn't become an obsession. And throughout the first retreat that he gave here, which was at my friend Eric Storley's house many, many years ago, Katagiri talked about planting the seeds of Zen and watching them sprout. And I thought to myself, oh yeah, that's his dim vision. Yeah. So Dogen says, enlightenment is ever intimate with dim-sightedness. Enlightenment is ever intimate with dim-sightedness. Can you accept that? You might not accept it, but it's true. It's true. Sooner or later you can accept that. Sooner or later you can. If we condemn our shadow side, we end up back in the Chatterbox Cafe, experiencing our life as a story, narrated by who? Our inner critic, maybe our inner tyrant. Lately, I don't use the word inner critic so much anymore. I use inner tyrant, because in my one-to-ones with people, that's what I'm finding. That's an inner tyrant. My goodness. Where did that tyrant come from that's so dominant? Our inner tyrant wants to hold things together, wants to become someone. But sometimes the circus animals are going to desert. And that's wonderful. That's wonderful, because the circus animals are, that's just our kind of persona that we use to get along in this world. So having him desert is good, especially if you do it with a teacher or a supporter in a sangha, a community. All doing it by yourself is not so good, because this persona we really depend on. So my friend Rick, his circus animals deserted him. So he, I have to fictionalize these a little bit. I don't make them up, but I have to fictionalize them enough that you guys won't find out. So my friend Rick, went to business school. His father was a business person. His father had a small business, and he, you know, got his MBA, did a small business, had his own small business, and then the business started going to hell. And ultimately, he had to declare bankruptcy and tell all his investors that they weren't going to get their money back and just close the whole thing. So, in a way, the circus animals had deserted him, because that's what he knew how to do. It wasn't necessarily what he loved how to do. Loved doing. He had never even thought about what he loved doing in his dim vision, in his heart of hearts. It's what he knew how to do. His dad had been a business person. He was good at numbers. It was just something to do, to be okay in the world and to have a place in the world. But the circus animals deserted him. So again, with a ladder gone, he had to lie down where all ladders start, in the rag and bone shops of his heart. And he was a meditator too, so his meditation helped him with this whole thing. A lot, a lot. So, with the onion, peeling the onion, on my book I suggest there are three layers, but I added a layer when I went over my notes. Layers. The outside of the onion is mostly our ideas, right? Our images, our memories, our judgments. That's the outer layer, where we spend most of our time, wasting our attention some on surface-level thinking. Then the next layer, our moods, right, are more subtle. They're more long-lasting. We're unaware often that our moods are influencing, but they're influencing. Even if you're a thinking type, your moods are still influencing. And next layer down, this is a lot of tears, It's fine to cry on the cushion. It's good to cry on the cushion. Good to cry. Good to cry wherever, because crying is a release. It's a release. And also it's an opening. Tears bring an opening. Bring an opening. So as we're getting into the onion, it's getting softer and softer. And we have our instinctual urges that we're unaware of. and that they have a life of their own and a force. We're just animals with brains. I know we like to think we're humans. We're humans, but what are humans? Animals with brains. And it doesn't. You can be as religious as you want, as spiritual as you want, sit in meditation for 32 years. You're still an animal with a brain. You still want comfort. You still want security. You still want companionship. You still want sex. So you get in touch with those. That's good. That's healthy. Rather than trying to diss them or transcend them, just get in touch with them. And then the innermost layer, or kind of the innermost layer, is the felt sense. That's our present sensations, the textures, the colors, the sounds. When our meditation is that still, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And if you are a meditator, you will experience that sometimes. The felt sense before you create these worlds, these circus animals. Circus animals will come and go, but you'll come back to the felt sense. And when you do that, you're on the verge of falling into mu, of falling into no-thingness. And let's see, Ted, would you get that for me?
Sure.
So here are the four vowels in Sino-Japanese that we do every Sunday here. And, you know, in Zen monasteries, they do them every 4 years. I mean, excuse me, every day, every 4 years. They do. I do them every day. And if you look at it, you'll see that the third line down, there's a character, a single character, and that character is mu in all four of them, in each of the four of them. See the second line down, even if you don't know Chinese, you'll see it's the same character. So, beings have no number, mu. Delusions cannot be exhausted, mu. Dharma gates have no limitation. Buddha's way cannot be surpassed, mu. So all four of these are grounded in no-thingness. In no-thingness. So, no longer caught by some idea of who we are or should be. Or other types of performing circus animals. We still see the circus animals. They're still running around doing their thing. We're just not caught by them. So we peel and we cry, and it seems like one after another. The more you do this, the closer you are to manifesting an authentic dim vision. An authentic dim vision. So now I want to talk about five ways to manifest our dim vision. And I've talked about this twice before recently, and first time I had three ways, and the second time I had four ways, and today I've got five ways, so you better watch out. I guess I'm too much of a Buddhist, you know, with all their lists. So. Five ways. So first of all, trust your dim vision. Trust it. Even if it's sort of nebulous, and trust it. It is nebulous. So example I'll give, I talked about my second teacher in the book, but my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he had a dim vision when he was a teacher, as a pretty young man, of coming to an English-speaking country and teaching. He thought that would be a place. He didn't actually know the difference between America and the UK, but he thought it would be a place where people might be hungry for meditation. But he didn't know. I don't know where that came from. He didn't know. He just had this dim vision. And he mentioned to his teacher, and his teacher said, "That's crazy. Those people are barbaric. You know, the Japanese think of us, or thought of us, maybe not anymore, as barbarians. They let the Portuguese in, but that was enough, Westerners. Then they closed things down about 1600 and said, no more gaijin. No more gaijin, please. So anyway, he had this dim vision. He just said, no. And he still had it. He had a little temple out in the country. Still had it. Its teacher died, but didn't get any encouragement to go. World War II came along, awful for Zen people, awful for everybody in Japan, World War II. But my teacher was totally against the war and tried to get away, tried to get to Manchuria. Finally did get to Manchuria toward the end of the war, and then came back and everything was in ruins. Still have this dim vision. Not very many people sat zazen with him, maybe two or three Japanese people. But then he got this English teacher named Miss Ransom. You can read about this in Crooked Cucumber if you want. Miss Ransom. And Miss Ransom was British. And Miss Ransom taught him English, and he taught her Buddhism. And he thought, oh, my dim vision, Miss Ransom. She's interested in this. And so they hung out together, and he taught her, and she taught him. And but he still had the dim vision. She didn't really sit in meditation much, but he liked her style. She had tea every afternoon. She did everything properly. She, just like the Japanese, she appreciated things. She was well-disciplined. She was well-manicured and very, very proper. And so then he's in his mid-50s, and that's old for Japanese men after World War II. He's in his mid-50s, and they say to him, well, in Soto Zen headquarters, you can come to the United States. You can come to San Francisco, and you'll have a chance to teach Zen to whomever's there. And he says, well, maybe I'm too old, but he still has his dim vision. So he comes to San Francisco, but he expects to be greeted by a whole bunch of Miss Ransoms. But instead he's got beatnik hippies. They're so unlike Miss Ransom. They don't know anything on time. They aren't well manicured. They smoke dope. They sing in the Zendo. They wear bells on their feet in the Zendo. It's actually, we had two people in a first sesshin that I went to, women wearing bells on their toes during the Kinhin. Suzuki just didn't know what to do. What is it? What is this? So, and he thought, well, should I go? Maybe I should go home. I made a huge mistake. But he stayed. He still had his dim vision. And we're here now because of that, really. Because of his dim vision, Katagiri's dim vision, we're here. So, trust your dim vision. Embrace not knowing. Take risks. Make one mistake after another and keep trying. So he trusted. Embrace not knowing. He didn't know. He fumbled around. He didn't know. So my friend Rick, after he had to close down his business, he didn't know. But he had he'd always had this sense that he liked working with kids, that he liked kids. But he never thought of doing that vocationally. It wasn't one of his circus animals. It wasn't what he'd been trained to do. But he liked it, and so he was staying home with his kids while his wife worked. And then he thought, well, maybe I can volunteer, try volunteering with kids. So he volunteered. He fumbled around at that. Then he found that he could do something at a Somali school where they were really wanted a few white people there, not just Somalis. He could do volunteer work there. Then he fumbled around at that. He blacked out pretty well. And he got a job as a charter school as a Somali teacher where he is right now. You don't have to have a teaching degree at that charter school. Having an MBA is fine. So there he is, his dim vision. So trust, embrace not knowing, take risks. Suzuki took big risks, and big risks in staying. I don't know how much he wanted to go home. I understand, I think this is from Andrea, who said to me that Katagiri wanted to go home too. Katagiri, our founding teacher here, also thought the San Francisco scene was pretty wild and pretty weird. He wanted to go home, but Andrea said his wife, Tamon, wanted to stay. Is that right, Andrea?
That's the way I heard it.
Yeah. So they stayed. And we adjusted, and they adjusted. And here we are, sitting together. Pretty cool. Pretty cool. Number four, make one mistake after another. So now now I'm going to do one on me. I have several on me, but this is one I'll try to do fairly concisely. I probably have done this before in some way or another. So when I went to college, I thought, well, I seem to have an interest in, even when I was a kid, in helping people who were suffering in their minds. I don't know why. I don't know, I'm just interested in it, so I thought I'd major in college, in psychology, in college. So I became a psychology major in college. And it sucked. It sucked, because all in the college I went to, which was thought they were a special college, the college I went to, all the psychology was experimental rat psychology and behaviorism, B.F. Skinner. So how was I going to learn? So I thought, oh, I made a mistake here. I don't want to do that. So I finished my major in speech and drama because I wanted to graduate. And then I thought, but I kept reading books on psychology. Anyway, I was interested in psychology. I had this idea that somehow I wanted to help people with their mental problems, but I didn't know anything. Then one of my sisters called me up from California. She said, well, Charlotte, my other sister, she's had a psychotic break, and she's been in the hospital, and she's been locked up. And I said, oh, well, send her out to Minnesota. I mean, this was my... You know, I had a dim vision about this. So send her out to Minnesota. So we were living in a trailer in northern Minnesota, me and my wife and my little son, a trailer home, right? And so she sent Charlotte out. Well, my sister Charlotte was not on meds, and she was actively psychotic. But I had been reading R.D. Lang. I had been reading about psychosis as a journey. A journey toward enlightenment. But Charlotte, when she walked in and saw my wife, insisted my wife was this neighborhood girl we'd grown up with, and my wife was suffering from amnesia. And so the whole time it was like that. And I was totally confused and upset, and like, what did I do? And this reading hasn't helped me any, and I had to send her back home. We sent her back home to California. So then I thought, but I still have this dim vision, right? So I thought, well, when I come down to Minnesota, I'll work with people with serious and persistent mental illness. So I worked in a home for people, many people in the community who had a community-based home for many people with schizophrenia. Huge, huge, almost like an institution, unfortunately. And I got a lot of skills. I thought, I'm getting this down, you know. But and then my brother committed suicide. And then I thought, oh, I really screwed this up. I couldn't even take care of my own brother. Oh, I can't take care of my sister. I can't take care of my brother. I'm just making another mistake. And here my brother's dead. You know, I was sitting here on the cushion, grieving day after day in the morning. But I still had the dim vision. I still had it. Then I got a job working for an agency, and I became the CEO of the agency. And I wanted to my dim vision. I would go to the legislature and try to get the legislature to give money to support community-based programs for people like my sister and brother who just got totally messed over by the system. But I went to the legislature, I didn't know the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats then. That was my learning. And And I got preached to a lot about, you know, that my clients, I call them that, should turn to God, should turn to the Bible. I got a lot of that. Still, not as much as there used to be. I'm looking at Jim, because Jim spent a lot of time at the legislature, too. A lot of that. So I fell down again. But then I found a few Democratic supporters, a woman named Linda Berglund, whom I got to be really good friends with, who supported me and had had mental illness in her family. And so we created these programs and got legislative money. So that is just making one mistake after another. And the last one. And so that means falling if in your heart you really want to do something, allow yourself to fall on your face. It's okay. You'll get good at falling on your face, and you'll learn how to spring up, because this is in your heart. It's not just what the circus animals are telling you to do. It's in your heart of hearts. In your heart of hearts. And the fifth one is keep trying. Keep trying. Trust. Embrace not knowing. Take risks. Make one mistake after another. Keep trying. Keep trying. Now that my ladder's gone, I must lie down where all the ladders start in the foul rag and bone shop of my heart. Although I would say the fertile rag and bone shop of my heart. Fertile. Inside there's something that wants to sprout. Something that wants to come alive in the future. That's deeper than the circus animals, which are what you should be, what you were taught to be, what your image of yourself is. Something in there. It could be little. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Little is big. Little is big. It's in there. It's in there. Which means letting go of the ladder. My first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, used to say, "No stepladders in around here." Although he did not say it that way. He would say, "No stepladders in around here." He was a kind of he was a yin teacher, not a yang teacher. No stepladders in. Stepladders in is later on, if we do this, we're gonna get this. The circus animals are gonna perform, and we're gonna get enlightened, or we're gonna get rich, or we're gonna get whatever it is. But no stepladders in is coming back to right here and just finding our heart center right here, right now. And right in the middle of the not knowing, of the confusion, discovering that life that's in here, that life force, that seed that wants to come alive. So if your vision is all worked out, be careful. Be careful. Maybe it won't survive. It won't either. It won't survive because everything's changing. How can it survive? Everything's changing. A worked out vision is going to get mashed. It's going to get totally mashed. Or maybe you'll get co-opted by the circus animals. You'll forget that it's not the vision coming from your heart. You've got co-opted by the circus animals. Happens to the best of us. And we're all the best of us. So. So it says in the Sandokai, where there is darkness, there is light. Dogen calls this the courage to go beyond Buddha. As children, we adopt a self-image that we get from authorities. My old self gives me security. Even if it's an inner tyrant self, it still gives me security. Still gives me. It's not a very healthy sense of security, but really, is it? Not very healthy. So, to the degree that we can let go of the circus animals, strategies we learn to feel in charge, to feel in control, to achieve, to accomplish, this means our willingness to let go of the person we used to be and creating a space for the person we've been all along. You've been all along. Wow. So I'm going to close with another no, maybe not quite close, but another poem by Yeats, The Coming of Wisdom with Time. Though leaves are many, the root is one. Through all the lying days of my youth, I swayed my leaves and flowers in the sun. Now I may wither into the truth. Though leaves are many, the root is one. Through all the lying days of my youth, I swayed my leaves and flowers in the sun. Now I may wither into the truth. Now we may begin to live from nothingness, from nothingness, from our heart of hearts, not covered up by all this other stuff. All this stuff is still there, but it doesn't have to cover up what's deepest inside us. This is what the Japanese Zen teachers call our life being supported by a mu. Once I went to, many years ago, I went to a sesshin with Yasutani Roshi, who was featured in Three Pillars of Zen. And it was a mu retreat. It was a seven-day sesshin. It was just mu. They called it a mu sesshin. And that meant that the whole focus of the sesshin in this Rinzai kind of way was on mu, on becoming the mu that you were by going into mu. And so when you met with a teacher one-to-one, he said, show me mu. And then you tried to show him mu, and then he kicked you out because it wasn't because you weren't really doing mu. You were still caught by the circus animals trying to perform in front of the teacher. So you'd have like two-minute doksans. I mean, I like had two-minute doksans, I think, twice a day for 7 days. Did you do this when you were in Chicago? Yeah.
Not
who. Oh, yeah.
Who and I. Whatever.
Oh, yeah, who. Who instead of moo. Pretty close, really. So, you know, the whole week we sat facing the wall, and the assistant teacher, a guy named Edo Shimano Roshi, would come up behind us and go, moo. Like that was going to help us or something. And in the Dharma talks, the teacher Yasutani would say, now, when you're sitting, think moo. Eat mu, taste mu, feel mu. Mu is your center. All this other stuff is just extra. Go into mu so that you can become the mu that you are. Mm. And they emphasize the hara. Mm. The lower belly, right? Well, we don't have that kind of drama. That's not our style. Although it was kind of cool. I liked it. I mean, being a theater major was kind of cool. But we have a dim vision that flows from our root, and we can come back to our root. We can come back to our root. We peel the onion, cry as much as necessary, and come back. Because with darkness within darkness, there's light. There's light right here. Right here. So I think that's what I want to say for this morning. And I would be glad to. It's only 22, so... Benton.
That painting, the calligraphy over there on the wall, is the character Mu, very stylized by Katagiri.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. Well, they can't see it, but they can't see it in there, but you guys can see it. Yeah, that's Mu, too. Uh-huh. Good. Yeah, you can see how that Mu is similar to the other Mus, but, oh no, actually it's very different. Wow. Wow. I don't know.
Actually, you have to know the sequence of which way you draw the character. You have to draw the strokes in a particular sequence.
Oh, I see.
And if you do it very fast and don't lift your brush up between the strokes and then shorten some of them up and lay them.
I see, because they don't even look the same at all. We'll have to have our But, you know, Mu doesn't look the same.
Right.
Because Mu is just being. It doesn't.
But all by itself, you're not even knowing what it means, it's gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. Other people. Rosemary.
So it seems to me like there's a tension between never giving up and knowing when it's time to give up.
So there's a tension between Rosemary saying never giving up and knowing when it's time to give up. And to me, that's based on your dim vision, meaning you have to see if your dim vision is still alive. Is it still there? And was this just an experiment that was a failure and that dim vision's gone? Sometimes we should give up. And the problem is that sometimes we move from our dim vision to just getting entranced by the circus animals and forget that it all came from just our aspiration to help all beings. And maybe we need to give up because we're so attached to the circus animals and just come back and see what the dim vision is now. But that's important. That's important. I think determination for the sake of determination is not so healthy for us as human beings. Not so healthy. No. Do you want to add anything to that, Rosemary?
No.
Okay. Other people. Well, we have a little more time here. We could end early, which would be fine. I'm going to sit for 2 minutes here quietly, just enjoying Moo, and seeing if any of you guys want to say anything. If not, we'll just move on. But,
Jim?
Yeah, Wanda.
I mean, that's interesting what Rosemary brought up. Kind of relating it back to how you started this talk about the tyrant. I think it may be important to distinguish between when a dim vision is driving you like a tyrant, or when it's nourishing and guiding you.
Oh, well, I completely agree.
Discernment, you know, then I think.
I think if the dim, could you guys hear Wanda?
Yes.
Yeah, I completely agree. I completely agree. The inner tyrant is just a lion, a wounded lion in the circus. But we're focused on the wounded lion, and it becomes so much of who we are that it's very easy to. Sort of move from our dim vision to manifesting it as the wounded lion. So that's good. Thank you. Then we just have to see that and come back. Bernie.
Either way, would you say that the dim vision, if we find it, is by definition right in the sense that we talk about right speech and right action? And
yeah, I would say that the dim vision is right, but that's not, when we talk about right speech and right action, we're not getting caught by duality of right and wrong. Right in terms of feeling true and real and authentic to us.
I've heard it contrasted with, you know, skillful speech, skillful action, that being the other, and that's what I mean when I say the sense of skillful
and,
vision.
And you know, I don't want to overdo this dim vision, but I think we all have something inside of us that wants to be expressed, that is unique to each of us. And sometimes it changes. It's going to change. Sometimes it's not there at all. Sometimes it won't be there. But our meditation process, our bare awareness, really helps us get in touch with it and manifest it. Yeah. Thank you.